Right, well, thank you very much, Michael, and thank you for inviting me to take part. I'm not sure whether I'm the one or one of two speakers supporting the government's foreign policy this morning. Time will tell, and I'm as intrigued as everyone else to find out what the answer to that will be.
So are we.
can I say that I think it's marvellous that you've managed to choose a relatively small room. This is the psychology of public meetings, is to cram people into a small room rather than have the same number in a slightly larger one. You have two former foreign secretaries present, and Jack and I were both privileged to do that job. Stanley Baldwin once remarked, he said, "In my cabinet, I have 14 members who wish to be foreign secretary and only one who wants to be Minister of Labour." Can't understand why, but there we are. Now, what I want to do is share with you a few thoughts. And I start with a very obvious point, that not only has foreign policy not changed fundamentally because there's been a change of government, but there would be something rather unhealthy if it had been. That would suggest some either deep identity crisis in the United Kingdom or something infinitely more radical than the nuances of foreign policy normally permit. So not just in this country, but in most democracies, foreign policy tends to continue, but with important changes and alterations, but the broad stream of our national interests do not suddenly alter and change simply because a new government has come into office. But having put that as my caveat, there are a number of points I think that I would want to draw attention to. The first point is an obvious point, but it's a rather important one, that I think what has been clear in the last year is how the day-to-day control of foreign policy is now very firmly and unmistakably back in the Foreign Office itself. And that was not always true over the years that preceded it. When you have very strong prime ministers, but also strong prime ministers who have a very personal position on foreign policy, and I'm not just thinking of Tony Blair, I'm thinking of Margaret Thatcher as well, then inevitably the control and direction of foreign policy becomes increasingly seen as a function of 10 Downing Street as well as of the Foreign Office itself. It is to some significant degree inevitable in the modern world that prime ministers will be much more involved in foreign policy than would have been true 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. But having made that concession, it has nevertheless, I think, been an unhealthy development of some of our previous past administrations, when foreign secretaries have not been able to do the job properly, and when prime ministers have not just involved themselves in the overall strategy, but become much more involved in the detailed implementation. That's the general point. The second point is that I'm more than delighted, and I must confess astonished, that William Hague has been able to announce not just a stop to the closure of Foreign Office posts overseas, but actually the opening or reopening of posts that were closed in the past. The history of the last 10, 15, 20 years has been one of contraction of the Foreign Office's visible presence overseas, of our embassies and consulates and so forth. I haven't got the time to go into the detail of that, but what I think is marvellous is the announcement that was made a few weeks ago that not only will that contraction cease, but there is actually a programme, despite the very obviously strict controls on expenditure, far more severe than for many years, somehow they've been able to find the resources to actually plan for the opening or reopening of a significant number of posts in various parts of the world, and that is marvellous. The next point I make is, I think, one of the most important changes that has already happened, hugely relevant to foreign policy, is the creation for the first time in the United Kingdom of a National Security Council. And not just a National Security Council, but one that is chaired by the Prime Minister, that has on that National Security Council not only the senior cabinet ministers with the most direct relevance, the Foreign Secretary, Defence Secretary, Home Secretary and so forth, but also the Chiefs of Staff and also the heads of the main intelligence agencies in the United Kingdom. And this is important, I think, for two reasons. First of all, it does mean that there is at least a much better prospect of a strategic approach to foreign policy and not simply the day-to-day reaction to events. Doesn't guarantee it will happen, obviously, but there's a much better prospect when we know the Prime Minister every week chairs such a council and has this constant interchange with his colleagues and with the agencies and the Chiefs of Staff. But secondly, also, what I think we are already seeing, compared with my time, possibly with Jack's, is that the heads of the intelligence agencies now have regular access on a weekly basis, and a more informal basis, to the senior ministers under whose auspices they serve. And therefore, whereas in the past these meetings tended to be sporadic, occasional, ad hoc, They are now so regular that the use of intelligence can be much more linked to the foreign policy objectives of the government and the implementation of that policy, and that, I hope, will deal with some of the very serious difficulties that have arisen in the past when, however good or less good intelligence was, it seemed to be operating at a slightly different set of ground rules to the implementation of foreign policy itself. Now, let me go into the thrust of the policy itself, and that is very important. There are changes compared to the previous governments of both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Some of these changes were already beginning to happen in the latter stages of the Labour government, but they have now become much more established. I have to draw attention, of course, I think, to what is, in my judgment, a much healthier relationship of the United Kingdom with the United States. And without going into the detail of the Blair relationship with the American government, whether it was the reality or the perception, again, not enough time today to go into that in any proper sense, whether it was reality or perception, there was a deep belief, both in this country and throughout the world, that the United Kingdom government essentially was anxious to not only support the United States, which most British governments wish to do most of the time, but were prepared to subordinate other interests to that to a far greater extent than we had seen in the past and which many people felt to be healthy. That, I think, is now an important development. The fact that it's now referred to, for what it's worth, not as the special relationship but as the essential relationship, suggests that the fundamentals of the interest, common interest that Britain and America have remain unchanged. The desire of both countries to cooperate is recognized and understood. We recognize and have to recognize the hugely disproportionate level of that contribution because of the enormous size of the United States' resources. America has been described not just as a superpower, but as a super-duper power, insofar as it, both in its defense expenditure, its diplomatic and political and financial clout, is not just greater than anyone else's, but greater than any almost any combination of other countries. So recognizing that fact, we are in a situation where the United Kingdom is seen by the United States for a combination of reasons, as providing serious added value to its own interests, as well as helping the creation of international support for policies that might need to be pursued. That was true under the previous government as well, but I think it was not perceived to be a sufficiently independent British policy that would allow for significant disagreements with the United States wherever that was appropriate. Let me just say a word, if I may, and it does flow from what I've just said, about the current Libyan operation. Because the single most dominant fact, certainly of the early years of the last government, was the willingness of the United States and the then British government to take action, if necessary, out with the express approval of the United Nations Security Council, and to think in terms of coalitions of the willing in order to pursue objectives and to use military power, including ground forces, in order to achieve political change. Now, fully recognizing that most of that had faded away, certainly by the time of Gordon Brown's prime ministership, and perhaps even in the latter years of Tony Blair's, what I think has been most significant and, I think, beneficial about not just the Libyan operation, but the way in which it has been addressed, has been the very strong position of the British government and indeed other governments that no action was going to be possible unless it had the express approval of the Security Council of the United Nations. Secondly, the British and French governments were able to pursue an interest and an objective which manifestly, in the early stages, was not the view of the United States government. But that did not harm the relationship, and indeed, in a very important way, might have helped deliver the final beneficial consequences in the Security Council. Because we had the very unprecedented fact of the Arab League, almost unanimously, realizing that without their intervention, there would be no Security Council resolution, there would be no humanitarian relief of Benghazi and intervention in Libya. The Arab League, perhaps for the first time in recorded history, came out publicly calling for UN military intervention, which they must have understood would be NATO-led, and that itself led to the Russians and the Chinese being unable to consider using their veto in a way they almost certainly would have done otherwise. So here we have almost a model of what ought to happen when there is some international crisis that requires a speedy international response of a humanitarian kind, where there is broad international but not unanimous support. The United States holding back, not saying that we must insist on our view being the one that prevails, not determined to lead it, whatever happens, but the international community in a wider way, in a more multilateral way, reaching a consensus, and that consensus has already done much to certainly safeguard eastern Libya and hopefully will lead to Gaddafi's departure in the not-too-distant future. So, in the limited time I have, I simply conclude by saying that I think both the structure of foreign policy, the fact that the Foreign Office is back at the centre of administering the foreign policy of this country, combined with the National Security Council, means we now have a process far more impressive than we've had in the past. The expansion of Foreign Office presence overseas through diplomatic posts is very much welcome, still modest, but it's going at long last in the right direction. And on the substance of policy, the most important area that was divisive in the past is, I think, now much more a force for unity. That we can see that in the right circumstances, with good professional diplomacy, you can get, and not always, but perhaps more often than was beginning to be felt relevant, you can get international agreement through the Security Council, which can lead to military intervention where it meets the tests of what should be required in order to give it international legitimacy. And that's not bad for the first 12 months. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. I'm now going to call Jack.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks, Malcolm. With apologies for those who'll be disappointed, I'm not going to disagree a great deal with what Michael has said, but put my own gloss on this, because, as has been said by Malcolm, foreign policy should broadly be bipartisan, and I, when I was Foreign Secretary, enjoyed not unqualified but great support on the merits by Michael on every key issue, and also by Ming on every issue, and I don't make this as a trivial point, every issue but Iraq. And regardless of whether we were agreeing or disagreeing on the issues, there was the closest and most confidential relationship between the three of us, and that is essential. And a country which is profoundly divided on foreign policy, particularly on party lines, is one which is weakened in international forum. The second thing is that I regard myself as a friend of William Hague and have done for a long time, and I'm not trying in any sense to be condescending here. I happen to think that he's made a good start, speaking ad hominem. He went through the same stories that roll off the press with tedious regularity within the first 6 months of any modern British Foreign Secretary taking the job. I think they probably hit Malcolm, they certainly hit Robin, they certainly hit my successors, where your competence and sometimes your paternity is questioned. It's sort of a blooding process, but he's got through that fine. And although the budgetary position, not least when I was there, wasn't as, in any sense, and I criticised William for this in the House, as he had painted it, our difficulty was that there was a very significant expansion of this, I mean, huge expansion, in posts in Afghanistan and Iraq. And although a good deal of the money came from extra funds from the Treasury, some of it did not. I am glad that the forces of darkness resident in the walls and also the psyche of people in the Treasury over many years have at last been dealt with. And Malcolm, with whom I will share a private joke about this, will know who I'm talking about as well as what I'm talking about as well. So that's good. On this issue of where the focus of foreign policy lies, I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But the simple truth is that there was, even at the height of Iraq, 9/11 and Iraq, it wasn't the case that we were mere ciphers in the hands of Downing Street. What is the case is that the closer you get to the engagement of the British nation in military action, the more the focus on that dossier shifts to Downing Street, and that has always been the case. I mean, that's just inevitable. And Malcolm, you talked about the last 60 years. Well, you know, just to go through it, actually, Attlee diddly things to Bevin. Churchill was pretty nearly his own foreign secretary. Eden certainly was. Macmillan, who had huge experience in foreign policy. Ditto. Harold Wilson, when there weren't any, we weren't involved in any particular wars at the time, was ditto. Jim Callaghan certainly was, and then we had Margaret Thatcher interleaved with William Hague, and then, but you know, not when Malcolm was there, but before that, not a good tale, because we weren't engaged properly as we should have been in Serbia and Rwanda. And then we had Blair, but my experience was that it varied very much with the dossier. And for example, on the absolute critical issue, Iran, that was led from the Foreign Office, and Tony basically let me get on with it within very wide parameters, as well as much else. On specifics, I think that in terms of setting a strategy, the agreement of the two defence and security treaties with France in November has set the scene for a very close and constructive relationship with Sarkozy and the French government, and in a sense the French nation on those areas. And that was seen from the way in which, because there was this, had been this very close cooperation at head of government level, as well as foreign minister level and defence minister level, it was much easier for the two governments to agree a common strategy in the UN in respect of Libya. And Francis, I mean, we started that process. It's very important that, and I applaud the government for building on that. And of course, although France, and I'll come back to this, has it a natural and almost unbroken alliance with Germany on economic policy, it cannot look to Germany as a partner in terms of foreign policy because of the intense neurosis in that country in respect of any foreign intervention. On Libya, I've supported the government, and so has my party, and I'm glad that the government was able to get a UN resolution. I just say, Malcolm, that of course there was a reason why, that in the last 10 years there has been a development of policy within the UN to allow, to, and even sets jurisprudence, to allow for interventions which do not, in theatres which do not directly pose a threat to international peace and security in the terms set out by the framers of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. Would that we could have had a prior resolution in respect of Kosovo, but we couldn't, because Russia was going to veto whatever was going on there. As you know, the UN Security Council subsequently approved it. But what's happened on the back of Serbia, of Bosnia, Rwanda, Kosovo, and much else has been the development of this concept of the responsibility to protect, which was then endorsed by the Security Council in terms of approving the report in 2005 and the resolution in 2006. And that's one of the key reasons why it's now possible to get that kind of endorsement. Other areas in the Middle East, I think the government's broadly got it right. On Israel-Palestine, I'm glad that the government is shifting perhaps more than we did, and this here this was very much Tony Blair's lead to say to the Americans, I'm sorry, we're going to judge issues on the merits. I mean, we did shift, but my view, not sufficiently. That said, I think that with the Arab Spring and the fact that Israel, if it doesn't understand this, is facing an existential crisis which it can't resolve from inside, because of the chaotic state of its politics, we have got to be firmer still with Israel. story yesterday in the Financial Times, those of you which told most of us know anything about Israel, what we knew anyway, but it's just a vignette of the problems facing Israel. 100,000 Israelis have applied for a German passport. The extent to which almost every Israeli with any finance is taking out an insurance policy of foreign citizenship is astonishing. And that country, in my view, it's not going to survive in its current form unless it's willing to make proper bargains, including over land and refugees and Jerusalem. And it needs to be pushed still further. And it also needs to be subject to even-handed rhetoric and comment from the West, including the UK. On Iran, I would like, although I'm in favour of being firm with the Iranians, I think we have to have a dialogue with them. We're not going to resolve the problem of Iran without a dialogue, and I think we need to see a shift there. Other areas, I mean, yes, in terms of our relationship with the US, although just you need to be aware that I think that the level of defence spending cuts has got dangerous, not least in terms of our relationship with the US. And if I were looking for some flexibility, which George Osborne spoke about yesterday, I'd make sure that flexibility was in this area. Russia-China, I'm not clear about what the strategy is, and that's a difficult dossier. And on Europe, William Hague famously said, I think, in the 2001 election, that we should be in Europe and not run by it. I mean, that's a sentiment we would all sign up to. However, given the Franco-German engine, I mean, what Tony Blair and I were trying to do was to insert ourselves into that, not only in terms of foreign policy. That was difficult because there was agreement between France and Germany over Iraq, but also in terms of economic policy. There is, in my view, great scope for a much more active British foreign policy and engagement in Europe, not least building on the concerns that many European, other European states have about being too dominated by a Franco-German engine or by this, might be preposterous suggestions that have come from Trichet, that Europe will now have to set up its own, essentially, I mean, to move towards a full-blooded political union in order to manage what is ultimately unmanageable, namely a single currency without a single country. Last point I just want to make is this. I think that the test is, has it been clear? I can't read my own writing. What was the next bit? Focused and effective. I think that in parts it has been both focused and effective. What is lacking, I think, is a clear narrative to frame what the government is doing. And somebody said to me in the reception just now, whatever else you said about the period of the Labour government, it was actually clear what the framework was, and I think that's a particular criticism I'd make. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, certainly, last but not least, Ian Campbell.
Yep. If I seem a little apprehensive, it's because these days Liberal Democrats don't get the chance to address so many people at one time. But I know I'm among friends. A lot of the differences in foreign policy are about nuance and emphasis. And therefore, as a result, there's a great deal that's been said both by Malcolm and Jack, with which I agree. And indeed, when Michael and I were forming the loyal opposition, or the disloyal opposition, then we often agreed about a lot of things. One area where we had some disagreement, of course, was the area of Europe. And one of the things which I think has been very interesting development as a result of the government, and I'm not sure whether this is in spite of or because of the coalition, then the attitude in foreign policy terms towards Europe has been pretty pragmatic. And it has not been the cause of great alarm and anxiety on the part of the Liberal Democrats, who are, after all, regarded as the most pro-European party. I'm not sure it's always been to the satisfaction of some Conservative backbenchers, but nonetheless, from the point of view of presenting a pragmatic and realistic policy, then this is an area where I believe quite clearly that the government has been clear, focused, and effective. I thought I might say a little bit about the relationship between defence and foreign policy. Once upon a time, these were two quite discrete subjects, with discrete departments, and often with very little joint or integrated thinking. And that's why I'd like just to go back to the conduct and circumstances of the Defence Review, which, if you remember, was conducted at great speed. It was conducted within a time frame which allowed decisions to be made at or about the same time as the announcements that George Osborne made about public spending. And I'm not saying anything now or anything that I haven't written about, but I think that those circumstances were inadequate. And I don't think that they were focused. Because essentially what happened in defence was that there was a fixed financial envelope into which defence had to be placed. Now, those who know about these matters will understand that the classic definition of the Defence Review is establish your foreign policy objectives, assess the military capability that's necessary to enable you to achieve them, and then find the necessary financial resources to provide that military capability. And I don't think we had a Defence Review of that kind, and I don't think anyone would seriously challenge that judgment. And of course, we do have a fairly recent illustration of where that was almost done, and that was in relation to the Labour government's foreign policy defence review of 1997-1998. One area I think they were less precise about foreign policy objectives, perhaps, than they might have been, and refused to publish the foreign policy base. But nonetheless, we have conducted successful defence reviews in the past, and many of the tensions which are arising within the Ministry of Defence are directly related to that. One of the curious things about the public is, you know, I don't think they care very much about defence unless you're going to abolish their county regiment, or even in some cases close down the local TA drill hall. And one of the things where I think we have failed, politicians in general, is to put the case for defence as being something more than simply jobs. It's with that in mind that I think that our foreign policy yet lacks the substance which it would require to have achieved if it was to justify the description which is the motto, if you like, and the theme of our meeting. There's been reference made to Libya. There'll be another statement by William Hague in the House at 3:30 this afternoon. Had we not intervened in Benghazi, and had Gaddafi fulfilled his promise to go from house to house, room to room, looking for revenge, then the debate about Libya would have been framed today in very different terms than those in which it is framed now, because we would have stood back and participated in something which is generally predicted to have been very likely to have been a slaughterhouse. And that would have raised in a very sharp way the whole question of what Jack referred to, now described not as the right of intervention, but the duty to protect, an evolving doctrine in international jurisprudence, which really had its origins in Kosovo, but has now been adopted as part of the United Nations responsibility. And therefore, one of the questions which I think issues like Benghazi raise is the extent to which we can ensure the effectiveness of our foreign policy by having capability available, redundant capability in most other circumstances, but which can be deployed in order to meet changing events. Now, that's a pretty fundamental question. And I don't actually think that any of us, any of the three parties, have sought to apply their minds to that. And Benghazi or Libya raises another issue, and it's this. If we intervene, one of the criteria for the duty to protect, originally the right of intervention, was that there were reasonable prospects of success. It wasn't just that all other diplomatic and political efforts had failed, or that there was an immediate humanitarian crisis. It was that we should have, that there should be a reasonable expectation of success. Now, if you apply that at the moment to Libya, then I think you can just say that that criterion is being fulfilled. But that raises another more fundamental question. Have we any right or entitlement to embark upon interventions of that kind if we don't have the capability to sustain them, or indeed to finish the job which we have set out upon? The other thing which arises, I think, in relation to the Middle East is the quality of prediction. Now, of course, as you know, the first casualty of war is always the plan. And Harold Macmillan, events, dear boy, events. But should we not have been asking ourselves hard questions about the Middle East? Should we not have been saying to ourselves, the governments which exist in the Middle East cannot exist indefinitely? Should we not have been assessing the fact that the younger generation, starved of work, starved of political influence, but sated with the information provided by modern information technology, was likely at some time to assert itself? And we, and all of us, no exemptions here, we were too ready to accept political stability by any means, coupled with regular supply of energy. And that, I think, is an obligation on us to look very critically at relationships which have appeared to be stable and which have been long-standing, because simply of the fact that that lifetime that they have may not be without limit. And then finally, on the question of Europe and the USA, if you had been in Westminster Hall 10 days ago, then a very large part of what Barack Obama said could have been said by President Reagan. And it could certainly have been said by George W. Bush. And although in the preliminaries, the discussion between our Prime Minister and the President was about an essential relationship rather than a special relationship, someone from Mars landing in Westminster Hall would have thought that the special relationship was all that counted. And I think there is that continuing ambiguity. And that really brings into focus the question of where we should put our defence effort. And I'm one of those people who argues very strongly for European dimension. Remember, it involves forced specialisation, common procurement, interoperability, all things which Europe has been rather poor at achieving in the past. But I just point to this, that if this is governed, for example, by the European members of NATO, we have a lot of people who insist on exercising political influence over NATO, but aren't willing to insist upon spending sufficient money in their defence budgets, which would enable them to make a realistic contribution to the military effort. And on the United States, definitely, we are each other's preferred ally on the right flank, but you can't think of circumstances where the United Kingdom would be able to pursue a separate political approach to one from the United States where there was some joint military action. Finally, let me finish by saying this. Maybe, just maybe, one of the questions we should be asking ourselves in relation to the United States is, would it not be better to provide niche capabilities, intelligence, special forces, a contribution to the nuclear deterrent, but otherwise to make our position one of closer integration with Europe? Not easy. Started at St. Malo. Concessions have got to be made. Difficult to argue sometimes domestically for these concessions, but these are exactly the kind of questions which our foreign policy has to answer.